Okay, so it's time now for the talk. Are you ready, Donald? Yes. Okay. I have to be careful. As some of you know, I've had clown training. I was enrolled in the Clown School of San Francisco, actually right at the same time that I was coming into being more of a full-time Dharma teacher. It was not part of the official training, though, is what I chose. Anyway, I won't go there too much more. What I want to do this evening is really to continue with the energy from our day long. How many people were at the day long? You can raise your hand. So, many of us, but not everyone. And so what I'd like to do is to continue the teachings, and in the meditation, we continued some of the practices from that day long, but do it in a way that brings people who weren't there, as it were, into the practice. And so at the day long, I focused especially, the theme was what? Was really on the heart of practice, dukkha, the end of dukkha, and awakening. And we focused especially on teachings and formal practice. And I didn't give as much time to bringing the teachings and practices into daily life. So that's what I want to do today and then a week from now, is to give more attention to how we practice with this core teaching of dukkha and the end of dukkha, which I'll explain in a moment for those who weren't there and maybe for those who were there, and to give attention to how to bring this more fully into daily life, both in formal practice, informal practice, and the different elements of practice. So I focused on these two core teachings. One of them, really interrelated teachings, the dukkha and the end of dukkha. And as most of you know, dukkha is the word that the Buddha chooses in terms of his most fundamental teaching. The aim of the practice is the end of dukkha. So let me very briefly say what that is. So this is again going to the heart of our practice and what we're aiming for. And as one of the great yogis, actually, of the United States once said, this is the great yogi, Yogi Berra. People know Yogi Berra? Yeah. When I grew up, I grew up in Washington. Yogi Berra was a baseball player for the New York Yankees. And my grandparents lived in New York. I grew up in the Washington area, DC area, and we would go to New York maybe twice a year to hang out with my grandparents. And I would sometimes get to go to New York Yankees baseball games. I don't know where I got it, but perhaps on one of those trips, I brought back a statue. I don't know, a statue of kind of a plastic image about this big of Yogi Berra, the catcher. Maybe I can bring it next time. I still have it. I got it probably when I was 10 years old, and it was more like at the time it was the equivalent of having a Buddha statue in my home. Right? And this is what Yogi Berra said. This is in relation to the core teachings about dukkha, the end of dukkha and awakening. Yogi Berra said, if you don't know where you're going, you will wind up somewhere else. So that'll probably be the deepest thing that I say today, but we'll see. So what were the teachings on dukkha and the end of dukkha. I mentioned at the day long, and I probably have brought this up at other times, that this can be a confusing teaching. Some of you know that the word that's usually translated as suffering is dukkha. In the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha's first noble truth is the truth of dukkha. And the third truth is the truth of the end of dukkha. And at other times, the Buddha said, I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. But this can be a confusing teaching, primarily because there are multiple meanings given by the Buddha historically or in the different teachings for the nature of dukkha, at least four different meanings of dukkha. And only one of them makes sense of the end of dukkha, which is the aim of practice. I'm going to say that that meaning could be called reactivity, grabbing after the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant. I'm going to say that that's the core of the entire teaching, the entire tradition of 2,600 years. And so the aim of the tradition is to end reactivity. The ending of reactivity is actually understood as equivalent to awakening, to nirvana. And so it can be expressed very simply. The aim of our practice is to move out of reactivity and be able to be with life without reactivity, with what we might call responsiveness. So it can be expressed very, very simply. The confusion is that the Buddha had these four different meanings, at least, of dukkha. The first, which was the most common meaning of dukkha in the language that the Buddha spoke, which is similar to Pali, which is the language that comes down to us, dukkha simply meant something unpleasant. And that's what's translated as suffering. But if we ask, does the unpleasant ever end? Not as long as we're alive. We always have unpleasant experiences at times of the body or the mind or the emotions. And the Buddha himself, after being fully awake, supposedly, had, when he was older, had headaches and backaches. The unpleasant, that sense of dukkha never ends. So that doesn't give us a clear sense of the aim of the whole practice. Said the second meaning of dukkha given in the tradition is dukkha related to impermanence. If we have a pleasant experience, it won't last. At some point, we'll have an unpleasant experience. That was said to be a form of dukkha, but of course, that never ends either. The third meaning of dukkha given was the sense that whatever is conditioned can't give lasting satisfaction. You know, whatever a taste, a smell, an idea, an experience, a relationship, accomplishment, a possession, whatever, they can't give lasting satisfaction. And this is taken to be the third form of dukkha, but that also never ends as long as we're alive. It's always the case, you know, that is true. So the meaning of dukkha that gives us the sense of how dukkha ends is given in a few teachings, and I mentioned these at the day long, and I think I've talked often about the first of them is the teaching of the two arrows. Remember that the Buddha says sometimes we have unpleasant experiences that he called the first arrow. Everyone has those, as I mentioned. And what the skilled practitioner does is learn how, because of the first arrow, not to shoot a second arrow as if that would help. In other words, not to, because of an unpleasant experience, push it away habitually, unconsciously, automatically. That's reactivity. You know, and we do that with an unpleasant experience at the level of the body. I have an unpleasant body experience. If I'm not mindful, I may tense around it. I've often said that about as much as 80% of some forms of chronic pain isn't the original pain, but it's the tensing around the pain. That's reactivity. That's the second arrow. You know, so we can do that at the level of the body, and obviously we can do that at the level of the mind. I have a difficult interaction with someone. The person says something I don't like. I say something back of a nasty nature. That's shooting the second arrow. That's reactivity. And that makes some sense of the aim of practice. It's also brought out in the teaching that I explored at the day long of dependent origination, which says, again, much like I mentioned earlier, that when we have a pleasant experience and we're not mindful, we'll tend to grab after the pleasant. Similarly, with an unpleasant experience, when we're in habitual mode, we will tend to push away the unpleasant at the level of the body or thinking or whatever. That's dukkha. That's what we practice with. And so in the guided meditation, there were several aspects of the guided meditation that help us to explore reactivity. And generally speaking, a huge part of our practice is to notice reactivity, explore it with mindfulness, be with it when it comes up, pause during the day to notice it, study it, study our 10 top forms of reactivity. You know, I've often joked that this could be a headline for a meditation center, but it's never the headline. The headline is develop calm, be peaceful, not have fun exploring your top 10 forms of reactivity. 10 of the 10 ways that you lose it. But that's actually crucial to what we do. You know, and so the guided meditation, we noticed how when we're with the pleasant or the unpleasant, we could notice how at times we could feel maybe some reactivity coming on. And again, the very crucial qualification is that the pleasant or the unpleasant isn't the problem. It's the reactivity, the habitual way that we grab at the pleasant or push away the unpleasant. And I think I mentioned at the at the day long how going after the pleasant isn't necessarily a problem, and resisting the unpleasant isn't necessarily a problem. Most obvious with, you know, this happened in an interaction, it was very painful for me, and I want to talk about it. And what that person did was unethical or inappropriate, and it was painful for me. But what I want to do is respond to the situation and respond and act on the basis of the unpleasant, but without reactivity, without shooting the second arrow. That's a lot of what our practice is about. And that's why I did the guided meditation, to let us see how very often reactivity gets caught up with discernment. This is very, very clear with what I call the judgmental mind. I may be judgmental of, let's say, I don't know, an official in Washington, D.C. Anyone had an experience like that, being judgmental of an official in Washington, D.C.? Anyone? A few of us. And I may have that experience, and the reactivity is a problem. Even if what I'm noticing has validity or discernment or clarity. So that's why I gave in the guided practice the fact that it becomes very crucial, and this is at the heart of the work I do with the judgmental mind, to explore reactivity, but we don't simply squash it. Because if we squashed it, we would lose the discernment. And I actually sometimes hear teachers saying, squash the reactivity, get rid of it, let it go. Sometimes that's valuable when it's overly intense, but when we can, the best strategy is not to squash the reactivity, but to transform it so that we preserve the insight and work through the reactivity. So that was the first core teaching that we looked at. And the second core teaching was about awakening. And I was connecting these because the teaching about the end of dukkha is related to the teachings about awakening. And when there is an end of dukkha, that could be called awakening. And the Buddha sometimes spoke like that. Well, very explicitly in the Four Noble Truths, the aim of the whole path is the end of dukkha, again, which I'm interpreting as meaning the end of reactivity. And so this can help us get a sense of the nature of awakening. I mentioned at the day long that the Buddha typically, much more commonly, gave an account of awakening that was more negative. Awakening is going beyond dukkha, let's say. Sometimes we say going beyond greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, so it's expressed in terms of what we end. You know, and I would say particularly dukkha. You know, because we could greed, when we use the language of greed, hatred, and delusion, greed and hatred are really code words that don't necessarily mean only greed in the sense of I'm greedy for that, or hatred. They're really code words for grabbing after the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant. So when you hear that with teachers, really understand that it doesn't always mean greed. And a lot of the, you know, greed is one form of the kind of reactivity in which we grasp after the pleasant. Hatred is one form of the reactivity in which we push away the unpleasant. But they, in the language of the Buddha and in a lot of the language of teachers, we use the code words greed and hatred to stand in for those. So just understand that those are not literally meaning, you know, greed and hatred all the time, if that makes sense. And so the way that we explored at the day long, a further way to understand awakening and nirvana is that it takes us beyond the ordinary constructions of our experience. And I think I'll give a little more attention to this in the guided meditation next time and in the teaching, that we go beyond the ordinary ways that we have a strong sense of self, the way that we have objects that we see out there in the world. I mentioned at the day long that the Buddha sometimes talked about awakening as reaching what he called the signless, the boundless, and the all luminous. Our being becomes like that. And the signless means that we go beyond the ordinary constructions of perception and the way we give labels to things in the world and to people. Awakening isn't caught up with thinking that the signs really refer to something. They're seen as constructions that we use to kind of navigate things, but they're not ultimate. And we actually have the potential, in part through the deepening of concentration, to experience the world without language. And we saw that most of us have had those kind of experiences, you know, in meditation or retreats where I see the sunset or I see the flower, what I'm calling the sunset and the flower, I'm using concepts, but I see those without concepts. Again, how many can relate to sometimes having those experiences? Being with experience, most commonly of the, the wilds, the earth, an object, what we call an object, but it also could be another person. I think when we're very close and intimate, we often go beyond concepts. I once did writing where I solicited people's experiences of having mystical experiences related to intimate relationships. It was very, very interesting that many people had had those, and we, I got some accounts which we published in that article. And so there can be that going beyond language, going beyond concepts, going beyond ordinary constructions, going beyond space and time, that this is a major way that the Buddha talked about awakening. I gave the quote at the day long from the Buddha. He uses the concept of the world as referring to our ordinary constructions. He says, "There is no reaching of the end of dukkha without reaching the end of the world." That's a little bit dramatic. What he means is the end of our ordinary constructions of the world. And it's maybe a clarification of what that means. It means that we have the capacity to go beyond ordinary constructions and live from that. But we also have the capacity to work with ordinary constructions, but we come more and more from an awakened place where we know their constructions. So the Buddha still used language, and he still spoke, and he still remembered people's names, and he still talked about trees, right? But he, in a way, had the capacity to really, for significant periods of time, to be apart from those, and so to have the sense that even though he was in the world of constructions at times, in a way he was at the same time beyond them. So we looked at awakening in that sense. We looked at awakening really in that, with that framework. And so how do we then bring all of this into daily life? And at the day long, I gave a handout. I think it was on 11 ways of cultivating or transforming reactivity. And I'll just mention some of these and really emphasize the way that we bring these teachings into daily life. The first of the ways of transforming reactivity was to continually, or is to continually, cultivate modes of non-reactivity, including mindfulness. Keep on cultivating mindfulness. Keep on developing the heart practices like loving kindness and compassion. Ground in ethics. Know what the teachings are. Cultivate how to respond in our speaking and our acting without reactivity. Keep cultivating non-reactivity. That's number one. A second that I want to talk about, I already mentioned, it's to really study closely our own personal main forms of reactivity. We can do that by reflecting on them. We can do it after the fact. We can make a list. We can deliberately, as we did in the meditation, the guided meditation, we can deliberately bring up the reactivity and study it, bring mindfulness to it. Bring up my experience of reactivity talking with that person do that for a minute and then explore it. So we want to know what our forms of reactivity are, you know, especially to help us identify them when they come up, and if possible, be mindful. You know, one of the wonderful form, very simple form of practice is bringing them up in our formal meditation, but then also when they occur during the day, identify them. If possible, take 5 minutes to study them. The key learning that we have with reactivity as we explore reactivity more is not so much that we immediately end reactivity, but that we notice it sooner. That's the learning, you know? So particularly with our strongest kinds of reactivity, we might notice, for example, the mind looping and looping, being negative about something I did or something someone else did, looping and looping. And instead of noticing it after 10 minutes, I notice it after 30 seconds. That's significant learning and practice. So we study our main forms of reactivity. The guideline that's very important is that we study our reactivity when it's in the workable range. When our reactivity is on a scale of 1 to 10, an 8 or 9 or a 10, it's not really workable and mindfulness is not necessarily appropriate, then we want to have almost like a repertoire. When it's a 9 or a 10, then we actually want to get rid of the reactivity, you know, to do something which ends it, you know, which we can do in a, you know, a few different ways. If we're meditating, sometimes a concentration practice, like with the breath or loving kindness, can end the reactivity. Sometimes we want to do something physical, take a walk, talk to a friend, but we want to have a repertoire of ways of getting out of very high levels of reactivity. When we notice ourselves in reactivity shooting the second arrow, we notice it and again, try not to feed it. We, particularly when something difficult has happened to us or something painful, watch out for the shooting of the second arrow. I think the most common guidance that I give to people, I think I've mentioned this in one-on-one work, is you've just had something difficult happen, painful, watch out for the shooting of the second arrow. That's my most common guidance in working with people. And it goes a long way. Another way of working with the reactivity is, as I mentioned, noticing the discernment. That can be really helpful, just reflecting. I got really judgmental towards that person. What was valid in my experience? Can I separate that then from the reactivity? Not easy. Again, that's the heart of transforming reactivity. Another way of working with reactivity is to notice that when we're in reactivity, we're not in our hearts, and to deliberately come back to the one's heart. I'm in reactivity. Maybe I've done some mindfulness. Let me then do maybe self-compassion practice or metta practice. Come back to the heart. I'll just mention maybe one other way of practicing is that we can increasingly know situations that we might be coming into where there can be some reactivity, or it might be likely, maybe a difficult meeting with a particular person, a difficult meeting, whatever, and set the intention, maybe multiple intentions. One might be to notice reactivity when it comes up and be mindful. Another might be to work with the reactivity in the moment and see if I can have a skillful response. might be when I'm at this meeting and I go into reactivity, let me take a time out using my well-known favorite timeout technique at a meeting or even at a family gathering, go to the bathroom. Go to the bathroom, recenter, so to speak, and come back. You know, and find ways, maybe I'll focus more on this next time, find ways to bring non-reactivity into speaking, working with the guidelines that the Buddha gave to be truthful, helpful, come out of a good heart, and have good timing. How do we bring non-reactivity into our speech? I think I'll give more attention to that next time. Yeah. How do we work with any reactivity that might be coming up in terms of what's happening in the world? How many people have had reactivity in relationship to what's going on, you know, whether at a national level or international level? How do we work with that individually? How do we work with that as a community? You know, it could be something maybe that we even do here. I've mentioned how having a venue for sharing and even opening to difficult emotions related to public events is often a missing piece. That's been very important for me. You know, so in other words, really to summarize everything, keeping the core understanding about dukkha and the end of dukkha is at the heart of our practice, bringing that into our daily lives, that we really then keep the vision of awakening alive in our daily lives. I think that's actually a crucial intention for our times. Even with really painful, difficult things happening, not to forget, not to leave aside the vision of awakening. In fact, as much as possible, bring them together. So, and let me close with two quotations. One is from, these both have to do with, in some ways, with the teachings on reactivity, dukkha and the end of dukkha and awakening. The first is from one of my favorite German poets, not very well known in the U.S. This is Friedrich Hölderlin, very short quotation. Where danger lies grows that which saves. Where danger lies grows that which saves us. So there can be both danger and the possibility of what's most vital. And then the second is from our friend Achan Cha from Thailand. Achan means teacher, Teacher Cha, who many of you know about, was the teacher of Jack Kornfield, and some of you know the teachers Tanisara and Kittisaro, Achan Sumedho, crucial for Philip. And again, someone I got to study with Achan Cha, and a real trickster figure. I could talk more about him another time. Really, but this is what he said. I'll close with this. We are practicing to reach the mind and heart, the old mind and heart. The original mind is unconditioned. This is the mind of awakening. In it, there is no good or bad, long or short, black or white, beyond the constructions. The nature of the original mind is unwavering. It is tranquil. So practice really means searching to find our way back to the original state, the quote, old thing. It is finding our old home, the original mind that does not waver and change following various phenomena. It is by its nature perfectly peaceful. It is something that is already within us. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Let's just sit with some silence for about a minute. See what may have resonated, see where there might be a question or a sharing. Let me open things up and we have some time for discussion. Any question or sharing? Liz, please.
Hi there.
Hi.
Many, many years ago, I would say 25, Jack taught us the concept of the absolute and the relative.
Yeah.
Which is wafting through my mind as you're speaking about this issue.
Yeah.
Non-reactivity, yes, it's lovely theoretically. I want to react because then I know I care. To me, reactivity, my caring is reactivity. I feel it in my body, I feel it in my heart, I feel it in my mind, and I know I want to do something about it. Non-reactivity doesn't sit well for me here. Maybe I'm just theoretically off the mark. So much of this seems so extraordinarily theoretical and divorced from feeling and heart.
Yeah, thanks, Liz. It really invites me to clarify a little bit more what I mean by reactivity. Let's see. I'm talking about reactivity as, and I was in the talk. I contrasted it with being responsive, and so the reactivity has qualities of being relatively unconscious, automatic, habitual, caught up with habits. So, in ordinary English, I might use the word react and respond synonymously. Here I'm using the word react, I'm not so much using the word react, but using reactivity to point to something that's negative. It's not the same as responding. Yes, responding out of care is crucial, right? I didn't talk very much about responding. That's crucial. And so I was really differentiating a way that we're on automatic pilot, that we're caught up in our habits and our conditioning, and in which we unconsciously push away the unpleasant and grab hold of the pleasant in 100 different ways. And I mentioned that we can consciously, you know, like out of caring, act with non-reactivity, let's say to end injustice. Maybe I'll just be brief here, but let's say an activist, I would say, is most skillful when that activist comes out of non-reactivity, you know, in the way that I'm using it, and responds skillfully out of care with non-reactivity. I would say that examples, I've done workshops related to this with activists, examples of activists being caught in reactivity might be very common phenomena when people are just angry and judgmental towards their fellow coworkers in their organization. Very, very common phenomena. That's because they don't have skillful ways to work with the pain, and so it leads to reactivity. And that, or it could be demonizing the opponents or demonizing the enemy. So very much this is about caring, coming out of the kind heart, but I'm using so it's really the language. I'm using the language of responding and differentiating it from, what I'm calling reactivity, which is unconscious, habitual, caught up in conditioning. So does
Okay, thank you. That helps. That helps a lot because you were leaving out responding. But once you bring it back in, there was so much weight onto the non-reactivity. I just felt lost. I didn't know what to do with my feelings anymore. So great to bring it back to responding. Thank you. That helps.
Yeah, thanks, Liz. Another question or sharing something that was helpful for you, maybe since the day long, some way that you brought the practice into daily life. Patty, please.
Thank you, Donald.
You're
I
welcome.
realized during your talk at the day long and today that I have been shooting second arrows habitually and frequently and daily in terms of reacting to my deteriorating physical health.
Oh my.
Everything takes me way longer than I think it should or that it used to. And rather than just admit that this is the way it is now and just be with the frustration and the slowness, I start screaming at how long it's taking me. I'm not screaming at another person. I'm screaming at my condition. And I'm realizing those are arrows. I can just be with the fact that everything takes longer and everything hurts a little bit and everything is just going to be more challenging than I would prefer. But I don't have to start hating it. And I don't have to start feeling sorry for myself because of it. And I realize I have a whole bag of arrows. And I need to put them in the closet. I just need to pay attention to what's happening and not react to it with such a foul mouth and a negative attitude.
Patty, thanks for that reflection. I just want to add maybe one qualification to what you said. And again, this comes a lot out of my work with the judgmental mind, which I would say is a major way to shoot the second arrow. It's that the in this case, what you're describing is driven by some kind of pain. Like I find that the judgmental mind is really driven by unacknowledged or unprocessed pain. And so it becomes very important. We can't go overly quickly to equanimity or some way of being with it. I'm not suggesting you're saying this, but to really to know that the moment of reactivity is driven by some pain. And can I be with the pain if it's in the workable range, maybe with mindfulness? Can I bring in compassion practice and maybe equanimity practice? But that unless we really can be with maybe the grief or the sadness or the anger, we have to be with those. And when we're with them, when I can really be with what's painful, I don't shoot the second arrow. The second arrow is we could say, is a kind of defense mechanism, so I don't actually feel the first arrow, the pain. So
Thank you.
does that resonate?
It does. And when I'm sitting, I can bring up the grief and I can feel the grief and I can feel the loss and I can feel the pain. But in the moment, I have trouble remembering what I was doing on the cushion.
That's right. So maybe set the intention twice a day, three times a day, to notice that when it comes up. And if you can, pause and bring your practice there. That's strong practice if you can do that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Patty. Maybe time for one more, and then we'll go to our closing. Please, was with me.
Angel.
Yeah. Angel.
Angel.
And hell. Okay, great.
Yeah, thank you, Donald. I was actually at Spirit Rock this past Wednesday and heard you there too.
Hello.
I'm pretty new to Marin. I came here from San Francisco about 6 months ago and pretty new to the practice too, actually. And had an experience while we were practicing of like a very visceral experience of seeing, especially in that super concentrated few minutes where we were looking at feeling tone and where it was in the body. Yeah, and then zooming out again a little bit, that was really effective. And then the talking about it, I find both times I've heard you, I feel like you have a really just very concise way of even quantifying how to do mindfulness, and it's very helpful. And so I had a pretty positive experience today with that. And I guess my question is, so as someone who is trying to work with reactivity all the time, it is helpful to hear about transforming it, like seeing it. I think that's like the beginning of the transformation is just seeing it. And like people have said tonight, like it's been really helpful to hear what people are saying. But I guess for me, where my question really is you talked about where the danger is, that's where it's like the no mud, no lotus kind of like where the danger is, that's where and I know just from what I've heard that, the Buddha talks about going into suffering as the way of liberation, not bypassing it, which is where the suffering is probably, right? And so I wonder though, like for me, okay, I'm like, okay, the dangerous place is maybe in myself, et cetera. But then I wonder about like in the world, like really dangerous places, like what do we do when someone is maybe coming at us with like either racism or homophobia or transphobia or, that kind of, I mean, I'm mixed race, I'm queer, I'm all these things. And I wonder, sometimes the pushing away feels protective, And I wonder, I wonder what you would say about that, what you would say about like honest, like when there's actual, how do you, how, what, am I supposed to absorb it? Am I supposed to see my own reactivity? And, I just, I wonder about that.
Where there's danger, where there's a possibility of harm, then the best strategy is just to get out of the situation. Right. I think that's pretty clear. It's kind of similar to the guidance I gave in terms of level of intensity. I said, it's an 8 or a 9 or a 10 on a scale of 10. Don't just stay with it. Basically, to quote the Buddha, get the hell out of there. Right. It's a paraphrase, not a direct quote. So I think the kind of extreme situations you're mentioning too really are the counterpart of the 8s or 9s or 10s. You want to, if it's kind of a dangerous situation, maybe there's some ways you can come back later and work with it, but you don't, the guidance isn't to be with anything extreme like that, where it's not, it's basically not workable. Yeah, does that get at it? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank
That's very, well, makes sense. Yeah.
you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anhel.